Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, December 15, 2012. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. The topic we have pre-advertised is the end of the Andrew Jackson disease. Now, that happens to be the same title as a statement that was issued literally a week ago in the afternoon, posted on LaRouche Political Action Committee by our guest today, Bill Roberts, whom we welcome from Detroit. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Marcia.
And Bill can speak for himself why he chose that title and so in a few minutes. And I hope all of you know or will soon know that he's raising it in particular on the occasion of the release earlier this month of a report, a paper by Michael Kirsch, the principal author working with others, on the which is on Andrew Jackson, and Michael's report's titled How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States. So the issue of our nation, destruction, who is behind it, and why the hell we're so susceptible to letting this threat take place is what we'll be talking about today. And so I'm also glad to have back on the show Paul Gallagher. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks. Hi, Marcia.
And people know Paul from the show, from many other, I'll call you prominent in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill, Paul, visiting, giving orders to people. But Paul, who you often read his material in economics in the Executive Intelligence Review, and Bill, you well know from the Monday weekly show on LaRouche Political Action Committee, with the candidate slate or the national policy slate for LPAC. So let me just say identify a couple of things, because we have two more shows as weekly shows of the LaRouche Show as we close out 2012, and please count on them December 22nd, December 29th. But here we are mid-month, and Congress has taken what would be its usual holiday break and then come back to form a new session in January. But the last thing anything is usual anymore. We're facing it's not a holly jolly Christmas, all that kind of stuff that's no good even if things were normal. We're facing a very an historic danger of war, and in our era, thermonuclear war. We're facing a worsening process of economic blowout, literal breakdown of essentials, as well as financial and monetary chaos. So we have a situation where, I'd just like to put it this way, to refer people to what Mr. LaRouche raised on his Friday webcast. He did so last night, speaking about a small percentage of people in our country today, and this happens at other times in history, maybe as much as 10%, maybe less, but this is the critical margin of those who are concerned about the world. They take things seriously. They have a constant nagging interest. You can think of that as your colleagues whom you may never have met in this kind of concern over the coming days of this so-called holiday period. And these are the people, including ourselves, who we're activating, pushing, because these are the people that we're shaping. We have an opportunity, we have a necessity to create a process to make a shift away from war and for the emergency economic measures to take to stop this breakdown process. So our guests will be talking more about this, but by way of update, I want to take one thing track of events of the day to illustrate what I'm talking about, that we're organizing to stop once and for all, and a pedigree goes way back, is look at the war threat of the drumbeat of escalating the strife based in Syria. Now, what happened over the last few days, and it's the process of the orchestration of this that I'm pointing to, not any one event, is that there was this construct called the Friends of Syria that met this week. Mr. Obama out of the White House announced recognition of the constructed opposition or rebel group in Syria. He announced that Tuesday night. Then the week closed with European leaders meeting yesterday, saying, okay, since since the new Syrian opposition group is coming into recognition and is so responsible, we now can send arms to it openly. That is, we don't have to try and send it surreptitiously. David Cameron from Britain, the leader of Britain, is gloating about this yesterday in a speech he made. Meantime, as far as continued armament, the deployment of Patriot missile batteries was approved this week by Holland and by Germany. They had to have their parliaments approval, not just their cabinets. And the parliaments voted, yes, they'll send a couple of batteries, a few hundred men, soldiers. The United States doesn't even send it to our Congress. Obama's announced there's going to be sending of about 400 U.S. Servicemen and women and a couple of batteries. So that's one situation. You have other flashpoints and places of imposition of misery in Africa, elsewhere in Southwest Asia, North Pacific, where the fires are stoked in the China Sea, and over. We could go on. So that's the point. This is a why are we tolerating this is a question, and who's behind it? Now, I'll just say two things about Michael Kirsch's new paper. One, of course, I hope everyone has got it, read it, bought it in multiple copies, downloaded. But in any case, you're dealing to say something about it most briefly, you're dealing at the time of the British East India Company or its transformation into the full-fledged government of England, of Britain. But what this expose report shows is very deliberate economic subversion of the new Republic of the United States. It shows through the Andrew Jackson's presidency the initiation of federal action to completely undercut the currency, to eliminate the credit mechanism that had been systematically providing funding for upgrading of the land, the water, the navigation, and necessary activity of improvements of the United States. And it was a period of terrific con job on the citizenry to even have this guy, Andrew Jackson, being presented as a man of the people at the time and then later on. So all I wanted to do, Bill, is get around to you to start off by saying you chose to write a short statement about this. It's addressing why people today are subjecting themselves to letting this happen. And your statement of the 7th of December called The End of the Andrew Jackson Disease reminds me about disease. It's almost like you need a historian epidemiologist, because it's a resurgent disease that we have today. We had it before and we continue to have it. So what do you want to say about this?
Well, I would just say that this report is extremely critical for as a discussion piece, amongst the lay of the population who, as Mr. LaRouche identified last night, that 10% of the population that actually is thinking about what we're going to do about the destruction of the nation, about this lurch toward World War III, about this hyperinflation collapse of the economy. And what this report, which is now out, How Andrew Jackson Destroyed the United States, I think what this gets to the core of is how to answer the question that how are we going to save the nation when most of the population and others seem incapable of doing anything to stop this crisis. And it really gets to the core of the issue of, it's almost shocking when you read this thing and it sinks in that we have not been a sovereign nation since the time of Andrew Jackson, that we've had some presidents who, like Lincoln, like FDR, Kennedy before he was assassinated, and others in that tradition, who have been able to organize kind of a temporary means by which the population can be unified around a common economic development policy. But really, since Andrew Jackson committed the act of tyranny of removing the deposits from the national bank, we've actually lacked the continuous means for industrial progress. That is, that there's always a process of reinvestment into that which is going to provide for the next generation and provide for the general population. When that was taken away through an act of tyranny by Andrew Jackson, and we failed to, the Congress failed to overturn that, we have been a party system ever since that. That is, in politics, what dominates is getting in line with the party, and truth is sacrificed in the name of being a good partisan. And so right now it's very clear that the only solution to becoming a sovereign nation again and shirking off this control, which right now is manifested in the person of Barack Obama, this control by the British Empire, is those individuals being able to act on the basis of restoring the American system of credit, which I think this report details very clearly. So I'll just say that to begin.
Right. Well, Paul, we can get into the content of different aspects of this, but what you've been talking to people about the you've been talking to people in both parties, right, about giving up this constraint and conceptualizing the need for credit, especially the emergency Glass-Steagall measure. Do you want to start there?
Well, constraint is certainly the right word. It's an intellectual blindness, which the real genius of the thing that Michael did that's now the pamphlet is that it puts its spotlight directly on the reasons for the blindness that most Americans, including the elected officials, for sure, the blindness which suddenly strikes them as if they were suddenly thrown into an interrogation room and couldn't see whenever they think about doing anything big at a turning point that clearly needs to be done. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. And it's a small example. It's a small example of something big. The destruction that was wrought by the superstorm, the request that was made in 7 weeks, not in 2 weeks like after Katrina, but in 7 weeks by the Obama administration. So it took it 3.5 times as long as it took poor George Bush, who was attacked up and down for this. But now the request's been made for $60 billion to reconstruct and potentially, to a certain extent, to actually build anew, on a new technological level, protection for East Coast cities from this kind of devastation. On the surface of it, it appears that everyone is for doing that. But this is becoming a very long, drawn-out process, which is very likely to go badly because the blind spot is that we don't, as a Congress, as a nation, immediately take the obvious step of creating an authority which is not subject to any of the conditions of budget debates and so forth, creating an authority to rebuild and to build protections anew. And it's immediately being sensed by many of the people in Congress who want to do this kind of rebuilding that this is not going to go well, that there's going to be a big problem in actually allocating the money. So they are turning around and saying, we need to just borrow a great, huge sum of money in order to make the Northeast whole, because the U.S. borrowing now is at virtually an interest rate of zero. Due to the Federal Reserve policy, the U.S. borrows money with Treasury issues practically at zero interest. So the more anxiety-ridden people in Congress and elsewhere who want to rebuild the Northeast and the cities that have been slammed there, say, we can just borrow a very large amount of money because it doesn't cost us anything now. They, in fact, would find that the door will slam on this instantly if the approach is taken that way. that this should be just part of general borrowing of the United States. National credit, the way that it in the pamphlet, it's described in real wonderful detail by John Quincy Adams, who's quoted at so much length, who was then the former president, the outgoing president, had been Secretary of State, was becoming the conscience of the nation in the Congress, and just put it in such beautiful detail that the United States was unified by a unique national credit system expressing itself through national banks, and that if Jackson destroyed it as he was destroying it, he would destroy the country, it would fall apart. Here was a man in 1835 absolutely accurately forecasting the Civil War, including what the issue would be and what the dividing lines would be, and that that Jackson was making that war inevitable. Without that principle, which everyone like Quincy Adams thoroughly understood at that point, that this is how we finance things in the United States. This is how we get important economic progress done. We have national credit, national banking. Not on one side or another of a political divide, all the people who worked for the Jackson administration also completely understood this and completely opposed what Jackson did.
Right.
He had to fire Treasury Secretary after Treasury Secretary in order to find one who would finally go along with him in destroying the bank. Because even everyone in his own party at the top ranks, congressmen and so forth, understood at that time how the United States got economic progress done through a national credit, national banking system. So it took a populist, heavily funded and externally directed populist drive eventually to enable Jackson to destroy this. And then over a long period of time, it became a blind spot where even the best informed people in the United States now tend not to have any real recollection or understanding that that is how we do things. So it's only when a really extraordinary president like Lincoln or Roosevelt does it that he manages to carry people along with him in doing it. But otherwise, no one understands what's being done. So this is going to fight itself out. We've made very specific proposals to a pretty good number of people in the Congress on how to apply this national credit system to rebuilding after Superstorm Sandy. This is really being circulated and read by a lot of offices there. It's the only possible hope. Otherwise, they're going to find the door slammed, and that, ironically, what W. Bush did for New Orleans after Katrina is going to look princely compared to what Obama does or doesn't do for New York and Hoboken and other places after Sandy. So, I mean, that's just one relatively, in terms of the amount of credit involved, relatively small example of this blind spot. So it's really, the pamphlet is a genius move to hit right at that. First thing people have to understand is, why don't we understand this? Why are we raised not to have any idea what to do in this kind of situation?
Do you want to, yeah, boy, Paul, you remind us of, I can think of some other examples about the function of, and the American system's unique identity in terms of credit, in terms of the sorry state of the entire High Plains region right now. Naturally, we should have gone on from FDR and Kennedy and have built the North American Water and Power Alliance. But a lot of those in the dried up Missouri watershed, Texas and elsewhere, don't see it as just where they're kind of fighting each other over shrinking water, I guess I'll put it that way, right? Bill, do you want to speak on any on the blind spot matter, or why have we been raised that we can't see? You've had just this new right to work law foisted on Michigan. And also, Paul, I think there were AFL-CIO meetings around the country post-election of Obama just kind of asking for a better treatment and not to have entitlements ended by the Obama administration. What do you want to say about that bill?
Well, I'd say in general, I mean, you can definitely see the way in which the identity of the population has been just turned into peasants. When you think about the fact that you have here in Detroit, I mean, you have the auto workers who are running around and saying that Obama saved Detroit, and they've got to support Obama because he saved Detroit. Meanwhile, Detroit is going into bankruptcy. That this mentality that, you know, the political identity of people is tied up in this idea that Lord Obama gave me a job, or begging for the scraps left over from the table. You know, it just illustrates the degree to which most people have lost a sense of what the role of the nation is, and the identity of the citizen. And also, you mentioned the Missouri and Mississippi River Basin in these areas. I mean, this is a prime example. This is an area of the country right now where the water is so low because there just hasn't been investment in the types of projects that are needed to keep water levels constant throughout flood and throughout drought, that there may not be an ability to ship the grain out of the upper Midwest this year down through the Mississippi River. And so, you know, ironically enough, Paul is bringing up the funds that are being appropriated to New Jersey and New York. And the newspapers, I think, 2 weeks ago were celebrating the great bipartisan cooperation between the governor of New York and the governor of New Jersey, who are on opposite sides of the political spectrum, supposedly, and that this is, you know, a great coming together. They weren't going to be competing for funds. But meanwhile, you've got this absolute disaster shaping up in the middle of the country, which could lead to skyrocketing fuel prices. If the coal can't be shipped out, you know, electricity costs are going to go up, or it won't be possible to move the coal through another means, and massive food shortages both here and internationally. So I think what Paul is bringing up about this blindness of seeing each area of the country and each function of the economy as a separate individual thing is definite. I mean, that is, we've lost the idea of a nation, it's critical that we bring it back. It's very clear.
Right.
Yeah, if I could just add, it's a continental wide, and we were trying to formulate it this way in order to organize in D.C. around it. It's a continental-wide urgent problem of water management, water protection in some areas, flood protection in some areas, even much more urgent drought relief in other areas by bringing water relatively long distances, but, you know, with the North American Water and Power Alliance, in a very economically totally efficient way in order to deal with these drought conditions, the loss of agriculture, the loss of the navigation in the major rivers in the middle of the country. This is really all one very large and new infrastructure platform for the country to manage water and prevent this kind of general economic destruction from cities to farms that's going on. So in that sense, it's like what Franklin Roosevelt came into office already thinking about, which became known as the Four Corners, where you had the major, at that time, unprecedented dam and irrigation system and water system projects in the West, the Tennessee Valley Authority throughout the South, the significant area of the Southeast, and even the beginnings of the work on the St. Lawrence, although that was left for Eisenhower to carry forward. But that whole development, FDR had a clear idea of how he was going to generate the credit through Reconstruction Finance Corporation financing in order to do it, a kind of incipient form of restoring national banking in order to do it. But if there was nothing automatic about it, because all of the other, the Wall Street and the City of London and all the European political forces that could be dragged along with them were banging on FDR's head and demanding that he agree that they were all going back to the gold standard and that they should do that immediately in 1933. Now, if they had done that, that would have been catastrophe for all of the investments of the New Deal and everything that Franklin Roosevelt is so justly famous for, just would not have happened. So he had to have a great self-consciousness of the American system that he was representing and tell all of this Wall Street pressure and all of this City of London and French and other European pressure about gold to just get lost. We're not doing that. We're doing the American system instead. And there's always going to be, it's never going to be just a simple matter of let's just keep doing what we're doing, but for some other reason, you know, which is the way many in Congress are thinking about it now. Let's just keep borrowing the way we're borrowing, but for good reasons rather than bad. Instead of bailouts, we'll borrow and do some infrastructure. You have to fight for the way this credit system works. And that's, this pamphlet is a real dramatic beginning to end, kind of on the edge of your seat, dramatic story of that fight, although it was lost.
Yeah, let me, well, if you throw in anything at any time, but I'll ask you another example here. It's kind of the blindness, except if you turn it around. Paul, you did an interview on LPAC. People can see that. It's around December 6th, December 5th or 4th, I think, for a half hour on the situation in the United States and also on the transatlantic financial blowout, economic crisis. But one thing when it comes to hyperinflation, I know Mr. LaRouche keeps emphasizing we're in the midst of it. We're in a process of it. It isn't as if, you know, if you watch some of these insane money channels on the television cable service, and they are giving their prognostications for 2013 or summing up 2012. And of course, they're crazy. We're in the midst of hyperinflation. But then you have Bernanke spoke this week about, you can say about that, but, you know, quantitative easing up the wazoo. And by the way, the new head of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, gave a speech in Toronto December 11th this week. And he said, it's really outmoded to try and keep inflation only at 2% in Britain. We should get rid of that. We need a new concept. And he said, we have to have growth inflation. So this is clearly such, this is not even snake oil. This is just lying in your face, and you suckers are supposed to believe it, or what, Paul? And some do.
I don't think a snake would buy it for a minute.
Okay.
It's Bernanke made these announcements Wednesday. And now they're going to be printing, at a minimum, at the rate he announced, they're going to be printing over $1 trillion in order to monetize more U.S. debt in the next year, in 2013. He very definitely left the door open, especially if there isn't one of these agreements, so-called fiscal cliff agreements, which is a term that he invented, that if he doesn't get that, he left the door wide open, said it's going to be more than $1 trillion in the next year in money printing by the Federal Reserve in a dead economy, a pure hyperinflationary policy. And he said, if inflation jumps up, we'll use that as a measure to regulate this policy, i.e., you were supposed to think we may print less with a high rate of inflation. But actually what he said is, we'll govern it by our expectations for what inflation will be 2 years out.
Oh.
And we'll ignore what it is now. We'll ignore all sorts of what he calls short-term fluctuations in inflation. We'll just be forecasting what we think inflation will be in 2 years. And that's what will guide us as to how much money we have to print. So this is the continuation of a hyperinflationary policy, but this is exactly coming to its denouement, because now at that rate, the Fed would buy almost all the U.S. debt issued in the next year. It would buy a pretty healthy chunk, like 70% or more, of all the fixed income public and private debt issued in the United States in the next year would be bought from the banks by the Federal Reserve and kept on its asset book, which would soar beyond, well beyond $4 trillion. A quarter, more than a quarter of the GDP would be the asset book of that one bank, which is, after all, a private bank. So it gives you an idea of the delusion of those in Congress and elsewhere who say, well, my God, with all this money printing and all this zero interest rate policy, the federal government can just borrow as much as it wants in the trillions at zero interest and do good things with it. The minute such a thing were to be announced, you have a Federal Reserve which is becoming the main creditor, really the only creditor in town for the United States government, and is already saying cut. The head of the Fed is already telling the Congress cut. He's not telling them go borrow $1 trillion and put it in infrastructure. He's saying you need to cut the budget. So that would clamp down immediately with this kind of attempt to use quote-unquote free money in order to invest in infrastructure. It's an entirely opposed system represented by the Federal Reserve, and will not function in the direction of national credit and national banking, never.
Right. One thing before, I looked up this morning, I was thinking of you being on, Bill, as well as Paul, but you just take some of the, what people are experiencing, how they see it is a different matter, but say that farmers or others in the Midwest, Indiana, Ohio, but then out into Illinois and Iowa, and the prices in last year, in 1 year, fertilizer prices, that'd be nitrogen, phosphates, and potassium, went up 30%. The land values of farmland for the last 3 years have gone up over 15% a year in certain places, but that's like Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, which is wacko. I mean, you need a steady, predictable situation if you're farming, a family farm or something. We have, if you want to look ahead to next year, the good and the bad and the ugly are all reporting how much the animal culling is going on of cattle herds. We're going to be having less beef in absolute tonnage here. The biggest beef processor in the world, but it's something called JBS based out of Brazil. It owns a lot in the United States. They figure on a worldwide basis we'll have 6% less beef next year than this year. I was looking at just buying retail steak. The price here in the U.S. has gone up 19% in the last 2 years, but that's before we had all of this cutting. And for the first time in something like 33 months straight this fall, the absolute amount of milk produced in the United States in tonnage terms is decreasing, from where it was a year ago in the month, because places like California, herds are being culled. Whole herds that took decades to develop are either going to slaughter or being bought out by a very few food producers. They're kind of in the realm of Howard Buffett, George Soros, you know, in the Walmartizing of farming. So I didn't mean to go on about this, but this thing about the process of inflation, the dynamics, you're in the Midwest, there in the Great Lakes region, Bill. You, on the one hand, you mentioned Detroit. Our cities, our productive centers, are being forced into bankruptcy. our rural areas are being buffeted by this, you know, whacked by all this kind of stuff. So you're out organizing. You might want to talk about the 10% who can see we've reached a state of, we're in the extremis right now. And some people, I hope, are, I know they are. I know that there's a critical few, though, that say, okay, this is it. We will have to face it and do something. What do you say?
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, there is a certain way in which, you know, maybe right after the election, there was a certain degree of shock. People were saying, I can't believe this guy got voted back in. But what we're seeing is definitely it's a really hot situation. I think it's both the economic situation where, you know, there are reports that this year for Christmas, you know, it's not going to be such a pleasant Christmas for a lot of people. A lot of people are having to go to the dollar store to buy their gifts. And, but I think, you know, the joblessness, but then also what's happening with let's put it this way. I mean, people know that this is a criminal administration, and I'm finding that after the election, you know, the fact that Obama won the election is not making people any less committed to the idea that he's got to be thrown out. Mm-hmm. That they can't see that if something doesn't change very quickly, that there's going to be another 4 years where there's, you know, a future to this country. So, you know, people are very up in arms about a lot of things politically. It's definitely not your normal holiday situation, you know, especially among a certain layer. I mean, I'm not getting that sense that people are just, you know, disappearing for the holidays mentally. So, I mean, it is an interesting situation in that respect.
Right. And I don't know if you want to say anything more. Both of you have already touched on this, but when I was thinking, reading the report, how Andrew Jackson destroyed the United States, it's just so clear it wasn't there. The report documents individual rotten, discreet actions that were perpetrated, such as removing the revenue of the federal government from being on deposit and in use. But anyway, there were other things done too. I mean, not the but it was one evil intent behind it, and that kind of jibes with what you just said. People have known, people were organizing, people who are activating, that we have a criminal administration, which is more than just, some were fighting against drones, some people were fighting, right? It's coming together. Is that what you're saying, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, it's, there's a general sense that, you know, that, I mean, people have a lot of different ideas about what it is that is going to kill them. I mean, a lot of people are concerned Obama's going to take their guns away or something like this, or there's a lot of the worry comes in the form of saying, okay, well, this guy's a tyrant. Uh-huh. And this is why we've got to do away with big government. And I think the important thing about this report that Michael Kirsch just wrote is that the issue is not big government. You know, big government gave us the Erie Canal. You know, big government gave us the Four Corners Project. Andrew Jackson was not getting rid of, he was not, his issue was not, he was destroying big government, but the problem today is big empire.
Uh-huh.
It's an important, you know, it's an important distinction, because people have this idea that, okay, we have to get rid of, they see what Obama's doing. They see the acts of tyranny, and they say, well, this really indicates that we just have to make government back into a simple machine for the protection of basic liberties. And that becomes the trap for blinding people from being able to understand the role of credit and you know, the role of the nation as a function of being able to organize the future. And that is probably the most poorly understood aspect of which we've got to get across to the population, to this leadership layer.
Yeah, I can see that. Do you want to address that too, Paul? You talk to different people, sometimes elected officials or their staff, and the concept of a positive concept of big government, if you want to call it that, is a challenge.
Well, you know, you have to get at one that doesn't refer to one party or the other.
Okay.
Because there's such knee-jerk reactions in various directions that come from being members of the party. I mean, you have people talking to you and you know they're talking about something they don't believe, mm-hmm. but it's their party talking point and that's the reason that they're telling it to you. And often it's hard to break through that by just arguing in some way an opposite point or a dramatically different point. You know, it's something. I think Lyndon LaRouche keeps noting it this way in the various discussions over recent days. there has to be a breakthrough in a person who's going to now do something about the terrible crisis the country is in. Even a person in an ordinary walk of life, let's say, but who is potentially has the skills and intelligence and potentials to be a real leader, mm-hmm. it's first a breakthrough to understand how completely blind about economics they are and why. And if they would then get angry that all of their neighbors are so stupid, mm-hmm. then, you know, and start to attack that stupidity, then they would be getting somewhere. And it certainly includes the organized labor movement, right, which is another
yes.
aspect of this and also of the hyperinflation, that you have to measure inflation also against what the average wage is. And that's, you know, it's acknowledged that real wages keep going down year after year after year for the last almost 15 years now continuously. This year, for example, the average weekly wage has supposedly risen by a grand total of 1% in a year. So it's obviously going down, but that's of the people, obviously that wage is measured for the people who are fully employed.
Yeah.
If you compared the same part of the population, the potential working population, now to 5-6 years ago, before this complete collapse, and you compared what their average weekly wage of a household, taking that entire population was, you'd have a decline that wasn't 2% a year, but more like 10% a year over that period of time, more like the amount of wealth that the average household has lost. So that's tremendous inflation against people, and it's become dogma all over the world, as well as here, that this kind of reduction of wages is a necessary step in economic growth. But you don't get economic growth unless you reduce wages. So that even though, you know, there may be people in unions who don't like it, nonetheless, it's a good, reducing wages is a good, according to the free trade central banking dogma, because it leads to growth of the country, and it's the necessary factor that leads to growth. So this is another total blind spot.
Yeah.
It comes from the same origin and says that you have to destroy the income of working people. You know, we can just go back and think of what Lincoln said about this in his famous speech about capital and labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the opposite. But the, you know, the labor movement does not have, even good labor organizers do not have, because of that blindness about the national credit system, which was also known as the American system of harmony of interests between investors, businessmen, and workers, because it advanced them all at once, because they don't know that, and that's become a blind alley for them. you know, they think that they're merely defending their own particular interests rather than defending the progress of the country. And it, makes them defenseless against the kind of thing that's going on in Michigan, where you apparently have most of the population, at least tacitly, backing the governor and the legislature in trying to destroy the bargaining rights of the labor movement there.
Yeah, you're there, right, Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking of the Midwest. You can, Paul, you talk about different blind spots. The fact that en masse, a lot of farmers figured there was no way there could ever be a price they would be able to rely on for their milk and meat and crops, field crops. So the corn growers went for ethanol, right? And are still saying you have to have ethanol. 40%, 50% of the crop maybe this year has gone for ethanol. And talk about blind. It's because they won't. Well, it's also demoralization and small-mindedness, right?
Well, I would say, you know, it's this belief in my money. I mean, there used to be a time in this country in which the labor unions believed in making a better country, actually waging fights in which the improvement was passed along to the entire population, which is really the conception of what a real economy is. If you make a breakthrough, you have a technological breakthrough, you want to pass that advantage along. Really, that should be an advantage for the entire economy. And people like Walter Reeder is a prime example. One of the, at a certain point, I believe it was after the war, there was a struggle to raise the wages of the workers without raising the price of the automobile. And it was explicitly done that way so that the advantage would be not at the detriment of the rest of society, but there would be a harmony. And that doesn't exist today because there's such a conception of an economic advantage is my money. And I remember Paul may be referring to this, but there was a reference to a speech that Lincoln, or not a speech, but there was a debate over whether or not an internal improvement project, a canal that was being built, and the canal lay entirely within one state. The argument was that no, this is actually a project of national benefit. And when the Democrats or the people opposing the project stood up to protest and said, how is this a national project? This canal lies entirely within one state. Lincoln stood up and said, well, it's quite simple, actually. And he made reference to how the price of the commodities being shipped from one part of the country to another would drop dramatically going both ways. He referenced sugar coming from the Caribbean and some goods going the other direction. In both cases, both sides of the country would benefit through the saving in labor which occurred. And, you know, that's a good kind of starting point for beginning to think about how the credit system functions as a matter of physical economic development, that it's actually anti-inflationary. It's bringing the cost down. It's not taking what's already there and trying to squeeze more out. That never works. That wouldn't work today because everything's collapsing. But through the implementation of new orders of physical principle, you increase productivity and you bring, you know, the cost per unit, physical cost of producing something down. And the benefit is to the entire population. So there's a certain principle behind this.
Right. Did you have anything more on that, Paul?
No. I mean, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely the way, you know, various things that Ruther did, just to take him as an example of somebody who had enough, you know, in the time after the war and before the Kennedy administration and also immediately before the war, had enough understanding particularly of what Franklin Roosevelt's administration was doing, but what the economic idea was behind that, that he, just as a leader of a very large labor union, new labor union, came up with idea after idea for serious economic and technological progress in the economy using the auto plants to bring it about. Because by using credit in that way, the overall productivity and technological level of the economy would be raised and more wealth would be created. He certainly understood that that was what a labor leader should be thinking about, rather than, as Bill was saying, rather than, how much money is in our latest contract, which is exactly what in bad times tends to turn other parts of the population against them. So that in the Michigan case, I think recently, and also in Ohio when they were doing, rather in Wisconsin when Walker, Governor Walker, was doing it first, his big attack was on the public sector labor unions, and very few of even the private sector labor unions backed them against him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really miserable divide and conquer. I mean, through ignorance and, yeah, it's a big operation. In the final minutes, I wanted to ask Bill, this seems like it's skipping around, but on the question of drugs, the legalization, the decriminalization, everything, is there something you wanted to say about that in light of what we're talking about?
Well, it's obviously, it's a big problem. I think this came up in the webcast last night. A lot of people think that, especially younger people, that, the right to destroy one's mind or brain or whatever is a freedom that they should have, and it's not the right of government to interfere with that. That conception of freedom is not a human conception of freedom. And two, one could just think about where this war to drug up the populations of nations sort of began by just looking at the opium wars in China. Why was it that when China got hooked on opium, that it was incapable for China's leaders to govern themselves? I mean, it's a very, or more recently, Mexico, and so I make a point to tell everyone who falls for this idea that look at who's behind, look at who's pushing this legalization policy. It's George Soros. It's the guy that brought in Obama, and look at the way in which this has destroyed the capability for us to have a population that can vote, that is competent and functioning as part of a republic. So it should be obvious. I mean, people should be educated. It's the fact that the voting habits of the population are so bad should be a testament to why we need decent education, but at the same time, it's also an indication of just how much the drugs have come to turn people into non-citizens. I'll just say that.
Right. One thing is the, if you want to, one could single out of the new report we're talking about that's the on the how Andrew Jackson destroyed the nation, on the rise of the role of the media as a capability to force things, right, of a way to think, and in this case drugs or many other things that you've been talking about, but that to present drug use as just an alternative lifestyle, all this kind of thing, you see tremendously in the, not just Hollywood, but the entire media for decades and decades. But during the time period of the of Andrew Jackson, this foreign operation was, I don't know if this is, it seems like it's a first. It really got institutionalized as a foreign, as an alien British Empire capability, right, Paul?
Yeah. It was kind of a trial run for the way the British then intervened around the Civil War and managed to accomplish the assassination of Lincoln at the end. It's just a conception that that we have to teach some people that there was a such a thing as pre-Jacksonian economics, which worked uniquely in the history of this country, and that it was never fully restored after that and became a weaker and weaker factor to the point where it's disappeared now. But that at that time, this was a system which awed the world and infuriated the British financial class and the British monarchy to no end, that the United States was pursuing this system and was therefore not only remaining unified, but also rapidly expanding across the continent from ocean to ocean while remaining an economic unit. You know, because that kind of expansion is not just a matter of making proclamations or conquering California. It's a matter of economic development across, all the way across from ocean to ocean, which makes it one country. And that was what the national credit system, the American system, was able to do. That's what Quincy Adams was saying in his attacks on Washington. So, you know, now we're going to get, I think, as Lynn was indicating, this is going to be a very tumultuous transition now through the Christmas New Year's period into the new year, with a lot of things of real criminality potentially being thrown up with regard to Obama, and also with some very, very deep economic crises immediately facing the country. We're fairly confident that Glass-Steagall is going to be introduced in the new Congress again pretty much right away. But Glass-Steagall no longer is being discussed by anybody as simply a banking regulation, but rather as tied to exactly this national credit policy that we've been discussing for the last hour. It's not a trick of how to regulate a bank. It's how to make the commercial banking system lend. Well, what are they to lend into? They have to, if you ask them now, they say there's not much demand for loans. We're not, even the honest ones, we're not making many loans because there's not much demand for them. What are they, and there's a great deal of truth to that in many areas of the country, what are they going to lend into? A policy of redeveloping the economy of the country on a higher technological basis, and particularly its lacking infrastructure. That's what they're going to lend into if Glass-Steagall is passed to let them do it. So that's the way we go after it now as the new Congress comes back in.
Right. Well, that pretty much summed up the look by looking ahead and what we have to do beginning now. And Bill, I know you Monday you'll be on the weekly show, I'm sure. And do you want to say anything in conclusion right now?
Well, just I mean, this what Paul just mentioned, that Glass-Steagall is the first step for destroying this criminal treason operation controlling our country, but that can't be discussed in and of itself, that a credit system is required, and that which the credit is going to be tied to has to be part of the whole discussion. So these three things operate as a single unity of conception, that anyone who's going to act seriously in a fight for Glass-Steagall is going to have that unified conception. And the major block to understanding the credit system as a top-down notion. The block to that is what this report, the Andrew Jackson report, is out to obliterate.
Mm-hmm.
This Jackson Treason Project and its legacy in the minds of the population. So to see it as a strategic weapon is, I think, the proper way to conceptualize it.
Great. Okay. So, okay, thank you both very much. And this, so Bill Roberts, Paul Gallagher, this will...
Yeah, thank you, Marcia.
Yeah, good. December, I was going to say the 22nd, no, December 15th, and we'll keep at it. And that will make things merry and a happy new year. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
So long.
Very good. Bye-bye.